Hello and welcome to the Semantic Cybersecurity Brief, our fortnightly podcast where we discuss all things cybersecurity. I'm Jake O'Brien and joining me today is Semantic Threat Researcher Bridget O'Gorman. We are back after a short break for the holiday period and we'll be once again putting out new episodes every fortnight until sometime in midsummer when we'll probably take another little break. In this week's podcast, we will be discussing new tactics being deployed by a ransomware gang, an interesting new multi-platform backdoor that has appeared, the latest way attackers are attempting to abuse Google Docs, how payments to suspicious cryptocurrency wallets have exploded in recent months, the corruption of open source libraries as a form of protest, and how one APT group was hoisted on its own petard. But first, let's talk about distributed denial of service attacks, or DDoS attacks as they're known as, because Cloudflare have recently put out some very interesting data, Bridget.
Yeah, so Cloudflare, which provides DDoS mitigation services to a lot of companies, they released the report about the trends they saw in the final quarter in relation to DDoS attacks, final quarter 2021 there this week. And this report contained a lot of information, a lot of statistics really about DDoS attacks in general. But the part of it that I found most interesting was information about the number of distributed denial of service attacks that came with a ransom demand during 2021 and particularly in the last kind of period of it. So Cloudflare revealed that in the final quarter of 2021, that ransom DDoS attacks increased by 29% from the same time in the previous year and by 175% compared to the third quarter of 2021. And in the fourth quarter of last year, Cloudflare said that just under a quarter of their customers had received a ransom letter demanding payment for an attacker to stop carrying out a DDoS attack, with this percentage actually rising to almost one third of customers by the end of the quarter in December. And I think this is notable. I think, as obviously we've seen some ransomware attacks. We've seen ransomware attacks really develop from, you know, ransom being demanded to decrypt data to ransom being demanded then also to stop attackers releasing data they've stolen. And now we're seeing ransom notes being deployed in DDoS attacks too, or also the threat of DDoS attacks being used as another form of leverage to get cybercrime victims to pay a ransom. And we have seen reports of various ransomware families, including high-profile ones like Avedon, Hello Kitty, or SpyPants, and the new ransomware family Yanduang, threatening DDoS attacks in an effort to extort money from victims over the last year or so, probably really in the last 6 months, I would say. So it is interesting to see that this kind of anecdotal evidence of an increase in these kind of extortion DDoS attacks does appear to be being reflected in these statistics from Cloudflare.
Yeah, it seems to be kind of making a comeback, the extortion motive for DDoS attacks. For a long time, it was just, a kind of a form of protest a way of disrupting organizations. But there seems to be a financial motive now returning to DDoS.
Yeah, it does look like that, definitely. But let's turn to you now, Dick, because you had a few stories as well that you wanted to discuss this week, including the discovery of an interesting new backdoor.
New malware is, of course, discovered every day of the week. But sometimes you see some stuff that catches your attention. And that's the case with a new threat that's called SysJoker. It was first documented by security firm Intezer this week. And I guess the first thing that jumps out about this malware is that it is multi-platform. And by that, I mean is that versions exist for all the major operating systems, namely Windows, macOS, and Linux. Intezer say they first became aware of the malware in December of last year when they found the Linux version being used against a server at an educational institution. That prompted their own investigation, and then they subsequently uncovered the Windows and the Mac versions. They believe that the malware has been in circulation since around mid-2021, and that assessment was made on the basis of two things. One being uploads of samples to VirusTotal, and the second was when the command and control domains used by the malware were registered. So all of the variants of the malware, they're written in C++, and while the Linux and macOS variants are kind of, I guess, self-contained, the Windows variant is a two-stage affair. So it starts with a DLL dropper that drops a zipped version of the SysJoker payload. The dropper then uses PowerShell to copy it to the disk on the targeted computer, unzip it, and then run it.
Okay, and is it unusual to see malware at multiple versions for different operating systems like this?
Well, it's not unique, but having said that, in the greater scheme of things, it is still quite rare. Even more so is the fact that you see multiple versions straight from the start. More usually, what we see is maybe the Windows version appearing first, and then the attackers might broaden their scope by creating new versions for Mac and or Linux or indeed other operating systems at a later date.
Yeah, I thought that was unusual, right, to have multiple versions from the get-go. And do we have any idea of who's behind this malware then?
None really as yet. Intezer's assessment was that this was likely the work of what they called an advanced threat actor. And that's something we'd agree with ourselves. That means the most likely motivation behind the attacks is probably espionage. Although, as they pointed out, you can't really rule out targeted ransomware, while custom non-ransomware malware is rare enough in the ransomware world. There is a lot of crossover in terms of the TTPs used with espionage attacks, so it can't really be ruled out.
Yeah, it seems like a sophisticated attacker with the development of the multiple versions, as we said, so be one to watch, yeah. I'd say.
Yeah, definitely one to keep an eye on, I think. And speaking of ransomware, we've also seen some recent attempts to get ransomware onto victim networks using malicious USB drives, which is kind of a novel vector when it comes to ransomware.
Yeah, certainly it is, I think, and probably something we'd associate with more, you know, activity from a few years ago, perhaps. Mm-hmm. But in this case, the Fin7 cybercrime group, which is known to be linked to the dark side and black matter ransomware families, has reportedly been mailing USB devices to US companies over the last several months in an attempt to install ransomware in targeted networks. The FBI itself actually warned in an alert that it issued last week. So the FBI said that the cyber criminals used both the United States Postal Service as well as the UPS courier service to send the packages, with the campaign reportedly ongoing since at least August of last year. And some of the packages were spoofed to appear to come from Amazon, while others impersonated the US Department of Health and Human Services. And if the thumb drives that were sent were inserted into a device, they would execute what's known as a bad USB attack. So basically the USB would register on the computer as a keyboard, and this would then allow it to send various keystroke instructions basically to the user's machine that would then run PowerShell commands that would then download and install malware that would give the attackers access to victim machines. And the FBI said that in cases it investigated, the group was able to obtain administrative access to victim machines and then move laterally across networks. And according to the FBI, the threat actors used a variety of different tools, including very commonly seen tools like Metasploit, Cobalt Strike, and PowerShell scripts, as well as using Carbonac, Griffin, Dice Loader, and Tyrian malware. And then they deployed ransomware on victim machines, and both the Black Matter and Rebel ransomware reportedly seen being deployed on the compromised networks during this campaign. And according to the FBI, among the targets in this most recent campaign was a US defense industry company that was targeted in November just past. It's also interesting to note that this is the second time that the FBI has actually sent an alert about Fin7 mailing malicious USB devices to US companies, having first sent one in March 2020 after security firm TrustWave found one of the malicious bad USB devices sent to one of its customers, who was a hospitality provider. So while you might think that, you know, we might be gone past the point where people would still be putting unknown USB drives into their devices, this recent activity, you know, indicates that this is still something that organizations and individuals need to be warned about, because while quite unusual, it obviously still is being leveraged by some threat actors anyway.
Yeah, I mean, it's a very old-fashioned way of attacking somebody, but I guess they're maybe trying to capitalize on the fact that it has kind of gone out of fashion, and maybe awareness about malicious USB devices has gone down in recent years, and then they might kind of hope that to just kind of take advantage of the fact that it's gone out of people's minds.
That's true, yeah, that could be a possibility for it, all right. Mm-hmm. And then our next story, I think, is also somewhat related to ransomware, Dick, because there was a new report out this week which found that deposits to illicit cryptocurrency addresses doubled during 2021.
Yeah, this report came from Chain Analysis. I always have difficulty pronouncing their name, but they're a cryptocurrency analysis company, and they always tend to put out some pretty interesting research. They also have good insights. But the main finding of this one is that illicit cryptocurrency addresses received $14 billion in deposits over the course of 2021, and that has almost doubled on the amount that they collected in 2020. I guess from our perspective, we see that cryptocurrencies are probably now the primary payment method employed, they definitely are the primary payment method employed by cyber criminals, most notably ransomware attackers. But one interesting thing is that while, you know, ransomware is not insignificant in terms of cybercrime, it turns out that it's dwarfed by other illicit activity.
Oh, really? I'm surprised by that. So what were the main forms of the illegal activity then?
Essentially cryptocurrency related scams, namely investment related fraud and straight theft. They all saw the biggest jump in 2021. So I guess when you think about it, yeah, maybe it isn't as surprising as we might kind of see it from our kind of angle, because, you know, obviously investing in cryptocurrency is gone insane over the past year or two. So anyway, revenues from scams increased by 82% in 2021, up to $7.8 billion worth of cryptocurrency. And they said a lot of this growth was down to what they call exit scams, where people set up what seemed to be like legitimate cryptocurrency projects, just steal investors' money and disappear. So in 2021, roughly $2.8 billion were lost to these exit scams. And then another $3.2 billion in cryptocurrency was just straight up stolen. And that's a 500% increase from 2020. And almost three quarters of these losses, notably, were from DeFi products. DeFi protocols, and that's a kind of like financial technology that operates on a peer-to-peer basis rather than exchanges like a lot of people use. DeFi also saw a significant increase in funds received related to money laundering, according to the report. Another interesting finding is also that while there has no doubt been an explosion in illicit activity, it is actually being outpaced by legitimate activity. That means that the proportion of illicit activity compared to the overall activity has actually fallen over the past year.
Well, that's kind of interesting. God, it really is huge amounts of money that's involved. I suppose we focus so much on ransomware and what we do, but when you think that, you know, nearly $8 billion was just kind of lost to scams, like it's crazy.
I know. I guess we're very focused on what we work on, and you know, the kind of the other malicious activity associated with cryptocurrencies, you know, we don't get as much exposure to it, but it is enormous, really. Let's turn to the next item, and that is that something you wanted to talk about, Bridget, the Commons and Google Docs were abused in a recent campaign to spread malware. So do you want to tell us a little bit more about how that worked?
Yeah, I just thought this was kind of slightly unusual, so it might be worth mentioning, though it isn't a new technique, as it was actually first seen being used at the end of 2020. However, researchers at Avanan said they saw a resurgence in this kind of activity in December 2021, with more than 30 organizations targeting a campaign that leveraged this technique, basically. So essentially what it is that malicious actors use a Google account to create a Google document and then comment on it, basically, and mention the target with an at, so they tag them in the document comment, basically. You know, those of us who use Google Docs at work would be very familiar with that kind of thing. And Google then obviously sends a notification email to the targeted person's inbox, to the inbox of the person who has been tagged, you know, informing them that another user has commented on a document and mentioned them. A notable thing here is that the preview of the comment contained in the email can actually contain the malicious link. So the attacker does not even necessarily need to share the Google document with the victim, or the victim doesn't even need to go into the document. They could potentially just click on the malicious link within the email. And the notification also, it only displays the name of the person who left the comment, not an email address. So this makes impersonation a lot easier, as, you know, it's quite easy to change your display name on Google. You know, it would be significantly easier than, for example, spoofing an email address. So also, as Google itself is being tricked essentially here in sending out these notification emails, you know, they're unlikely to be stopped by security tools as these emails are being sent by Google. So it is a tricky one to guard against, really. And I suppose it does rely to a certain degree on people being aware that, you know, this kind of malicious activity exists, really, and to be suspicious if they're tagged in a strange Google document or one that they can't access, things like that. So it's kind of something to be aware of. And Avalon said I had informed Google about the resurgence of this kind of activity recently as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's something you could imagine being fairly effective with an attacker who's done their homework, you know, and if they get the name of your boss or a colleague, for example, and spoof their name, you know, it is kind of likely that somebody might fall for it if they don't look at it very closely.
Yeah, definitely. You could easily see how someone could fall for that trick pretty handily. But let's return to you now, Dick, because you also had an interesting story you wanted to talk about an APT group that managed to infect itself with its own malware.
Yeah, I think more than a few people got some laughs out of this one. So the report comes from Malwarebytes, and it concerns an India-linked APT actor. This is variously known as Patchwork, or Dropping Elephant, China Strats, or Quilted Tiger. Anyway, Malwarebytes was investigating a new campaign by the group that involved the use of malicious RTF documents that were impersonating Pakistani authorities to infect targets with a new variant of a rat known as Bad News. The malware is also known as Ragnatella. Anyway, the campaign was underway in November and December 2021. So in the course of the investigation, they discovered that the group had seemingly managed to infect themselves with their own malware. And as a result of this blunder, Malwarebytes was able to kind of get, on an unprecedented level of visibility into what the attackers were doing, because they said they could see captured keystrokes and screenshots of the infected computer and virtual machines. They could also see that the attackers were running both VirtualBox and VMware machines to do web development and testing, and their main host had a dual keyboard layout that was English and Indian.
Yeah, I mean, that is really quite inept on the part of the attackers. But did Malwarebytes explain how they were able to see that information being captured by the malware?
Yeah, it was pretty comical. I mean, while OPSEC breaches can and do happen, this one was kind of a biggie. And you imagine that some heads would roll in Patchwork HQ, wherever that is. With regards to the second part of the question, the answer is that they were fairly vague about that. And I suspect that might be kind of intentional, lest they tip their hat to the attackers on how exactly they got this level of visibility from the self-infection. So finally, Bridget, you had something of an unusual story yourself that you wanted to discuss.
Yeah, I just thought this was kind of an interesting story that I saw this week. So the developer behind the popular open source libraries Colors and Faker purposely corrupted them last week, leading to thousands of applications that use the libraries no longer working. So the developer, Marak Squires, he intentionally introduced an infinite loop to his two libraries to basically break any apps that were using them. So users of the apps then were faced with gibberish messages on their consoles, which included the text "Liberty, Liberty, Liberty." And Squires apparently did this in protest at large corporations and commercial consumers of open source projects increasingly relying on free software while not contributing to the community of people that develop and maintain this kind of software. So the Colors library that was corrupted receives over 20 million weekly downloads on NPM alone, and it has almost 19,000 projects relying on it, while the Faker library receives over 2.8 million weekly downloads and has about 2,500 dependent projects relying on it. And Squires has previously said that he was no longer going to support Fortune 500s and other smaller sized companies with my free work. And this move that he made, it drew, I suppose, mixed responses, with some praising the developer's actions and others, you know, sort of criticising them. Squires' GitHub account was also reportedly suspended following this action. which also drew a mixed response from members of the community. And I suppose whenever you think of Squires' actions, it does raise some interesting questions about the reliance that can exist on open source projects. You know, we have spoken before about how open source projects can, in some cases, be exploited and leveraged by attackers to get malware onto potentially, you know, a large number of networks or users, depending on how many people might use a specific open source project. And, you know, a very recent example of that, for instance, is Log4j, which is an open source library. And we saw the kind of havoc caused when that was compromised because it was so widely used. And, you know, the fixes for it, you know, have largely relied on the work of some of the unpaid developers behind it. So while Squires' actions may be extreme and people might not agree with them, you know, there probably is a conversation to be had there about the reliance that does exist on open source software and the kind of issues potentially that can cause.
Yeah. I mean, I guess the long and the short of it is that he probably does have an interesting point, but maybe the way he went about it is up for debate.
Yes, I think that's fair. It's a fair assessment.
Yeah. Okay, let's leave it there. So we're nearly out of time. But if you've been enjoying our podcast, don't forget to subscribe to avoid missing out on all of our future episodes. You can also follow us on Twitter at Threat Intel. And if you'd like to read our latest research, you can check out our blog, which can be found at semantic-enterprise-blogs.security.com/blogs/threat-intelligence. We'll be back again in 2 weeks' time, but until then, thank you and goodbye.